I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Today on the show, Maryland Congressman John Sarbanes talks about his idea to get more Americans and so-called small money involved in political campaigns, a way to counter recent Supreme Court decisions that favor big money and corporations. Also in the hour ahead, we'll hear about a project just outside of Baltimore to use algae to counter the effects of power plant pollution. Plus, what might be next for the old Peale Museum near Baltimore City Hall? It's been closed for 17 years. And Baltimore County Librarian Paula Gallagher has two books to recommend, both about the high-octane, high-pressure world of the professional chef. One a novel, one a memoir. Midday Friday starts after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. Another snappy hour of informative radio ahead. During this hour of Midday, we'll meet Bob Moroz, the owner of a Baltimore startup that uses algae, you know, pond scum, to reduce pollution from power plants. So stay tuned to find out how that works. Sarah Gantz joins us from the Baltimore Business Journal today to talk about her story regarding the new Horseshoe Casino in Baltimore, and whether it will get to hire as many local residents as had been hoped. We'll also hear about an effort to reopen the old Peale Museum near City Hall in Baltimore. It's been closed since 1997. Two of our guests today have a plan for the Peale. They'll be joining us in about 40 minutes. And Paula Gallagher from the Baltimore County Library has two books to recommend. And then at one, it's Midday on Film, and here's something I would like you to ponder in anticipation of our second hour today. Who was the most surprising actor or actress on the big screen? The star you didn't see coming. The one you saw in a TV show, maybe, or a movie, and your reaction was, meh. And then one day, he or she shows up in another film, and almost out of nowhere, steals the show and convinces you that they had real acting chops. My pick on that is George Clooney, and I'll explain why an hour or so from now, when it's time again for Midday on Film with Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed. But, of course, we welcome your participation, so ponder that question, and we'll get to you in the second hour of our show. Right now, I want to take a few minutes to follow up on our recent Midday discussions about the recent Supreme Court decisions that favor wealthy donors and lobbyists with regard to political campaigns. There was the troubling Citizens United ruling in 2010, of course, and just a few weeks ago, a decision in the McCutcheon case that would appear to favor people with millions to spend on multiple political campaigns. We spent some time talking about a bill sponsored by Maryland Congressman John Sarbanes to counter the effects of those Supreme Court decisions. The idea here is to get more Americans and so-called small money involved in political campaigns. Representative John Sarbanes, welcome back to Midday, John.
Dan, how you doing?
Good
to be here.
Good. It's nice to hear from you. And as I said, we touched on this a little bit a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about the McCutcheon ruling, because that's the most recent ruling with regard to campaign financing. So I want to hear from you about that. First, your reaction to the McCutcheon ruling, and then tell us about this bill that you've been working on.
Well, the McCutcheon case is just, you know, it's another example of this court, the Roberts Court, sprinting down a path of just taking the limits off of big money in the country, giving more influence to big money campaign donors and PACs and super PACs and so forth, which is going in the opposite direction of where the public wants to see us go, which is to put limits in place and do something to empower everyday citizens out there. This court, unfortunately, is not going to do anything anytime soon to rein in that big money. So we have to think of how to push back on it. There's the constitutional amendment effort, although that's very tough to do, to amend the Constitution to allow those kinds of limits to be put in place. It's worth pursuing, but that's a long haul. The other thing we can do, and this is where I've concentrated my effort, is create a way of competing against the influence of the big money by creating a small donor-driven public funding system, matching system, that would come in behind candidates who really reach out to everyday citizens and lift them up, so that if you're a candidate, you have another choice on how to power your campaign. You don't have to go to the McCutcheons of the world. You can turn back to your constituents, to everyday citizens, and be able to raise enough money there that you could actually run a campaign. And if we had a system like that in place, that's what the Government by the People Act that I've introduced is designed to do, I think it could be transformational.
Well, tell us how it would work, John.
Sure. So there's a few elements, but the first is we want to get more participation from everyday citizens. So we offer a refundable tax credit of up to $25 in each of the 2 years of an election cycle for contributions that are made to congressional campaigns. We call this the My Voice tax credit because it's a way to empower everyday citizens to say my voice does count. And the idea is let's make it a little bit easier for the average person out there to get into the funding side of campaigns so it's not just dominated by the big donors out there. So that's the first piece, the refundable tax credit, and that's critical. But the second piece is just as important, and that is a multiple match of public dollars that will come in behind those small donations at a rate of 6-to-1, so that a candidate who commits themselves to raising money from small donors knows that a $10 contribution will be turned into a $70 contribution. The reason that that's critical, Dan, is it's the incentive for candidates to actually turn back towards real people to fund their campaigns. It's the match that allows a candidate to be viable by relying on small donors. So what you would see happen if a system like this was in place is the candidates who now have to go hat in hand to the Sean McCutcheon and the big money campaign donors of the world in order to raise dollars for their campaign could turn in a different direction. They could turn to everyday citizens and raise money that way. So those first two pieces, the My Voice tax credit, the what we call the Freedom from Influence matching fund to come in behind that and boost up the voice of everyday people. And then we have a third piece, which is sort of home stretch support, which is in the last 60 days of a campaign, candidates who are facing an onslaught of outside money could get some additional resources to help keep their voice in the game. Those combinations, that combination of those three things, I think, can really empower everyday citizens to take their government back from the special interests and the big money. And that's why we're excited about it. And we have a tremendous national coalition that's getting behind this bill.
How do you fund it, John?
Great question. You have the combination of the small donations, and that's got to be part of the mix. People have to come out of pocket a little bit in order to make this work. But the public funds that would come in behind this, I would fund by closing the loopholes that the very industries who have the most influence in Washington have been enjoying for years. So let's take the example of the oil and gas industry, which still gets $5 billion in taxpayer subsidies every single year. You could pay for the system I'm talking about for, 10 years just by closing that one loophole that's enjoyed every single year by the oil and gas industry. You look at the Wall Street influence in Washington that has managed to keep in place these incredible tax loopholes for Wall Street. Close a couple of those, and again, you've got plenty of money to underwrite a system that puts the voices of everyday citizens back in charge. So it's very doable. And at the end of the day, Dan, what I say to people is, look, somebody's going to own your government. Either it's going to be big money and special interests, in which case when it comes time to make policy, that's the direction that Congress will lean in, or it's going to be everyday people and the public. And if we do it that way, then policy will start getting made for the public instead of getting made for the special interest.
A couple of questions. What makes you think candidates, either incumbents or new candidates, would accept this system? I can see where if you have a pretty safe seat, this might look pretty good for you. You could take the risk and do it. But what about those who are really challenged or putting up a challenge?
That's a good question. When we were putting the bill together, and we spent 2 years crafting this very carefully, I consulted with my colleagues because I wanted to create an option for them that was viable. So we actually modeled for every one of the members of Congress how they would fare if they participated in this system as against their 2012 fundraising profile in the current system. And we were able to demonstrate that for the great majority of members, they would raise at least as much, if not more money, by participating in this small donor-driven matching system as they do now in the current system. And that was critical because, you know, you're making a good point. If nobody participates in this, can it really have the kind of impact that we want to see? Can it really empower small donors? And we were able to demonstrate that it would, and we think there'd be tremendous uptake by candidates and members of Congress if this option were available. Look, members of Congress are spending a tremendous amount of time, 30, 40, 50, 60% of the time of the average member of Congress is spent on fundraising in the current system. If you create a small donor-driven matching system, they could spend less time cold calling high donors, more time with their constituents and real people who would also be the folks that are then powering their campaign from a financial standpoint. Hmm.
I remember speaking with you about this a couple of years ago because you experimented with something like this in your campaign in 2012.
Exactly, and we were successful there, and we've come back with an even better experiment in this cycle. What I've done this time, if I've selected 100 precincts across my district, and in each precinct I'm building a multiple matching system where I find higher traditional donors to be the matching fund, and then I go out and try and recruit small donors to take advantage of that match opportunity. So in other words, in the absence of a public matching fund, I've raised it privately, but I'm using it the same way as an incentive to those small donors. And Dan, the behavior change that it's brought about in me is exactly what you would see in candidates across the country if we had a national system like this. I'm spending time now doing house parties, reaching out to small donors. I was in Parkville the other day knocking on doors, asking people to contribute $5 to make their voice count. I was as far as you could be from a K Street fundraiser. I was like 10 million miles away from K Street when I was doing that. So this is what you would see candidates begin to do across the country. The other thing is a lot of candidates, good candidates, don't even get into these races or put their names forward because they don't think they can get through the money primary. If you have a matching system like this, people can bubble up out of the community and say, you know what, I'm going to go run for Congress, and they can be competitive and they can win, and I think that'll be good for the country.
And John, Sarbanes, what is the status of, is it H.R. 20, Resolution 20, the Government by the People Act, what's the status of it?
So we have about 145 co-sponsors right now, which is a terrific showing from my colleagues. It is bipartisan. We don't have a lot of Republicans. We've got one right now, but we're working on it, and I think we can build.
That's
I think
bipartisan.
We can build from there. Yeah. What's most exciting, Dan, and this is the game changer this time, I think, in terms of legislation like this being successful, we have over 45 national organizations that are pushing this out to their members. And these are people you hadn't seen before join the effort around reforming campaign funding. The NAACP, Greenpeace, the Sierra Club, Friends of the Earth, labor organizations. Why are they coming to this? Because they understand that the progress they want to see on their substantive issues is being stopped every day by the influence of big money. So whereas in the past they might have said, well, you know, campaign funding reform, that's not our issue. Now they're coming to it and saying, we have to make it our issue, or we can't move forward on the environment. We can't move forward on civil rights and other important programs out there. So they're pushing it out, and in 8 weeks, we've collected over 420,000 citizen co-sponsors for the Government by the People Act across the country. People can Google Government by the People Act, and they will find plenty of information. They can go to governmentbythepeopleact.com and sign petitions there. And if they're interested in what we're doing here in the 3rd District, they can go to myvoicedoescount.com and learn about that effort. I think this has staying power, and I'm certainly going to stay committed to it. We're going to keep building support behind it.
John Sarbanes represents Maryland's 3rd Congressional District. And in addition to what he just cited, you can read more about his Government by the People Act on the Dan Rodrigues Facebook page, where we just posted a link to some information about that. Thank you, Congressman Sarbanes.
Thanks very much, Dan. Take care.
Stay tuned, folks. After this short break on Midday Friday, using algae to arrest power plant pollution. We'll hear about a Maryland company that's working on this when we get back. Welcome back to Midday Friday. Dan Rodrigues here, joined now by Bob Morose, CEO of a Baltimore area company that's trying to use that slimy, goopy stuff found on ponds, algae, to capture carbon pollution. Yes. The company is High Tech Bio, that's H-Y-T-E-K Bio, and it recently received a grant to commercialize its process. We'll talk about that with Bob Morose, M-R-O-Z. Bob, nice to have you in the studio with
us. Well, thanks, Dan. Appreciate it.
So go ahead, dig right in and explain to us, what's the connection between algae and arresting carbon pollution?
Well, what's amazing is what really got me was when I got the formula, it takes 2 tons of CO2 to make one ton of algae. And we first started looking at biofuel like everyone else did, but that was sort of an epiphanal moment. And I said, wait a minute, what am I doing this for? You know, we should be using algae to mitigate greenhouse gas, CO2. So I studied up, my degree is electrical engineering and computer science from College Park. Spent 30 years with the FCC. I started really digging into what's a bioreactor? What's a photobioreactor? What's photosynthesis? How does this all work? And when I finally put this all together and took sort of a little model over to the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Sciences, they said, hey, this really works. This is really, really, this grows algae really fast. So that whole concept went into getting some funding from the state through the Maryland Industrial Partnerships Program, which is great. Maryland Clean Energy Center was just sort of developing at the time. They helped us. Baltimore City saw what was happening. They had some DOE funds, so they pitched in $250,000. So we put up a really, really nice facility right at Back River Wastewater Treatment Plant, where I grew up.
Mm. Right? You grew up in Back River?
I grew up in Edgemere.
Close right. enough to smell it.
Yeah, very right. too close to smell it. Right, exactly. And we're right next to the golden eggs there, which has all the methane. But it's really neat. What we do, the technology is really, really simple. We can burn anything. You can burn coal, oil, natural gas, whatever you want to burn. You get an exhaust or a flue gas from that. And we take the flue gas, the exhaust gas, and put that into our bioreactors, which is filled with algae. The algae grows really fast,
These
really
are big,
thick.
Big cylindrical tanks, right?
Real big. They're 4 feet in diameter by 20 feet tall. They're really, you know, massive. And when you first see them, you don't want to stand too close because they're just overwhelming. But they're filled with algae, and it's a special strain of algae.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a minute.
Yeah.
The idea is that the CO2,
yes.
right, accelerates the growth of the algae.
Absolutely.
So you grow algae really fast in these tanks.
That's
but
right.
it was a particular type of algae that you discovered that's right here in the Chesapeake region.
Absolutely. Again, that's through state funding, and we had the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Sciences take 128,000 strains of algae, which they have access to.
Wow.
And out of that, basically I said, there's a lot of requirements, but basically I said, I need this algae to live at 40% CO2. And Dr. Feng Chen there at the university said, I don't think so. You know, most algae dies at 10, 15%. And we went through and we found a couple of strains of algae that lives at almost 100%, 75, 85%, which is mind-boggling. And it just so happens that it came from the Chesapeake Bay.
So this might be an algae that would bloom someplace out in some of the rivers or in the bay itself?
Part of the problem that you see in the bay because it grows very, very fast, you know, and there's lots of nutrient because of runoff in the bay.
So what do? You seed the tank with some of this algae and then it grows and grows and grows.
Exactly. And you have to do it really, really special because algae will grow. You grow algae in your pool, right?
Right. Oh, sure.
Which we all do, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's useless because it's not a single strain. It's not heavy in lipid oil, which is what's valuable. It's not a good protein. It's just wild, skinny algae, right? The algae we have is really fast-growing, high in oil, which you could make biofuel out of it. But that oil is omega-3 fatty acids, what the fish eat in order to get their omega-3. So it's high in nutraceuticals. It's a pharmaceutical. It can make bioplastics out of this stuff. You can thicken paints and cosmetics.
Oh, I'm glad you're mentioning this because that was going to be my next question.
Yeah.
Once you capture this the CO2
yes.
in this algae, so you have this CO2-rich algae in tanks in Back River or wherever you set up, because eventually you want to set up next to power plants, right?
Power plants, landfills, wastewater treatment plants. Yes.
So what do you do with it? Isn't it it's got too much CO2 in it, doesn't
well,
it?
Well, the CO2 doesn't exist anymore. Actually, it becomes part of the algae.
It becomes part of the algae.
Right.
It makes the algae grow fast. Okay.
Exactly. Right.
I got you. And then talk about some of these other uses of that algae once you're done with it.
Yeah, the algae is just amazing because it's extremely high value. Like I said, you can do biofuel, but you can only get about 10 cents a pound for biofuel because if you're trying to keep the price under at the pump under $4, you're already 160, about 16 pounds, so it's $1.60 for enough to make 1 gallon, mm-hmm. right? So if you're already at $1.60 and now you have to process it and distribute it and retail it, 10 cents a pound. But for bioplastics, you can get $30 or $40 a pound, $40, not cents, but
it
dollars.
It can be used in the making of plastics.
Yeah, bioplastics.
Plastic
and it's biodegradable plastics, okay? And that's really important because whether it's a nutraceutical you put in your body or you make bioplastics out of it or thickeners, that all closes the loop for CO2. Because what happens is when it's done, the cup that you make out of bioplastics or the dish degrades in a landfill that makes methane that you burn to make more algae.
Getcha.
It closes the loop.
You mentioned thickener. It can be used in paint?
Paint. It's already being used in Behr paints. Behr uses algae, form of algae oil for that. But cosmetics. It thickens cosmetics. What's really cool about it is because it's a nutraceutical, it's rich in protein and whatnot, in omega-3, it's a food additive, not just for animal, but for human. You could feed the hungry of the world if you have enough algae.
Could you just describe, because we're on radio here, just a little bit for our listeners, take us inside your plant.
Yes,
it's just a big building with these tanks in it and certain lighting inside. Just describe it a little bit for us. It's right next to the Back River Wastewater Treatment
Plant. It is, right. Large building, 30 by 30 feet, really tall. But we bring the flue gas in and we compress it and push it, basically inject it into these big tanks, which is 4 feet wide in diameter by 20 feet tall. So you're standing there, you get a lot of these tanks. And they're just bubbling, and you really can't see the lights because they're inside the tanks. The light is very special, too. We do some really, really special stuff so that we feed the algae only the light that it wants, only the light that it uses for photosynthesis, and we do some special stuff like that.
So the best conditions for algae growth.
Absolutely. The absolutely, absolutely best conditions. But the building is big. It's a concrete floor. It's an industrial complex, and that's really what you need to do in order to make this work. As a mitigation for greenhouse gases,
It's midday Friday. Dan Rodrigues here. We're speaking with Bob Moroz, who is CEO of High Tech Bio, explaining this company, this process or project he's been working on for 4 or 5 years now.
Almost five, right.
And Baltimore City, you mentioned earlier that Baltimore City had some money from the Department of Energy.
Mm-hmm.
So they granted you access to Back River and the methane. And so you've been focusing all your work there. Is that right?
Most of the work is there. That's really the demonstration. So I had the director of biomass from China fly in and spent all Saturday with me there, 5 hours. I've had David Haberman, who's known for world algae and fuel cells. He was there just the other day. So I'm getting people from all over the world. Now, so I use that not only for a production center, demonstration center, and experimentation as we're moving forward and making things better, but as basically a center for bringing everyone in for tours and discussions. It's really neat to sit in the middle of all of those tanks and all those lights and everything going on and having a discussion with another expert. It's really neat.
Speaking of those tanks, they sound kind of expensive. It sounds like the startup for something like this could be expensive. But did I read somewhere that you've been experimenting with Mylar tanks
that are
cheaper to use, that the algae can grow in them as
exactly.
well?
One of the biggest problems with closed bioreactors. Everyone says open ponds or closed bioreactors. Open ponds, the water dissipates, dries up, you get wild algae flying and everything. It's just really a problem.
Need a lot of room, too, for a pond, right?
Exactly. Whereas closed bioreactors, everything's controlled. The problem with closed bioreactors is you're using stainless steel tanks, and they're $100,000 a piece. Our laminated Mylar, which we developed and we've patented, that tank now, the same size tank of $100,000 stainless steel tank, is $10,000. So we've brought the price of the closed bioreactor itself way down by 90%. Those are really neat. They're laminated Mylar, like the kids' balloons, but a lot thicker, obviously. But it will self-stand. There's no structure at all. It will self-stand at 20 feet with 8 tons of water or 8 tons of culture in it. It's just a remarkable sight to watch.
Well, that must have been an important breakthrough for you, because you're looking to commercialize
right.
this process so that it can be established, set up in other areas, as we said, next to power plants,
yes.
next to landfills.
Right.
So what is the next step? I wanted to report here, you want to report, Bob, that you received a grant
yes.
From a, this is an outfit or a nonprofit in Canada?
It's a nonprofit set up by the government, but it's a corporation. It's the Climate Change Emissions Management Corporation up there.
Of Canada.
They sent, they established a worldwide contest, basically, and said, we want to find a technology that will mitigate 1 megaton of CO2 per year. That's your goal. And be able to produce valuable products from the carbon you capture. So we submitted to that. They had 344 applications out of 36 countries, and we wound up being one of 24 finalists that received the $500,000. But what's really cool is it's what we're doing already. It's almost like it was written for us. But now we get 24 months to show we can do what we say we can do, and in 24 months they will pick 5 of this 24 and give them $3 million. So we're going 100,000 miles an hour to get there. And then after that, they take the 5, do another 24 months, and select 1 out of that 5 and give them $10 million so they can commercialize.
Does our state here in Maryland or our federal government have such a program like that that awards grants for that kind of research and development?
DOE does.
We mentioned a DOE grant.
Yeah, USDA Agriculture. A lot of them do. I've put in 20-some requests for grants, and we're – I like to say we're just too small. You know, the big boys get the money.
What is the critique of the model? Is it that maybe the products that you're talking about from the carbon capture aren't as valuable as you think? In terms of the business model, where's the tricky part?
Our business model is really interesting. The algae will actually produce more money than the installation of the scrubber, what I would call the scrubber. Algae, we can sell the algae right now for about $40 a pound at a brokerage. We don't even have to convert it to a product. So we produce the algae, we can sell it. I'm anticipating that overall we can average out at about $10 a pound. But when you're generating basically a ton a day, or on a power plant, you're generating 7,000 tons a day of algae. Your profit margin is really high. But our business model is to come in, get a local investor to fund, let's say, a scrubber at a landfill or a power plant, install that facility, then pay the investor back very quickly, so that handsomely,
mm-hmm.
so they want more projects. And then after we pay the investor back, we then give the scrubber to the municipality, for example, plus enough money from the sale of the algae to do O&M plus a profit. So our technology winds up being a profit center for whoever uses it. That's the business model real quick.
How long have you been hooked up with the emissions from Back River? How long has this been going on?
Been 14 months, and we're mitigating about 5% of that plant.
Mm-hmm.
Ted Atwood at Baltimore City has asked us to give him a quote to move from 5% to 100%. So we're in the process of doing that now. We were just asked by Maryland Environmental Services to give him a quote to mitigate a landfill on the Eastern Shore. So so it's beginning to happen. We're moving very quickly into commercialization. And what I was thinking about doing is this $500,000 we got from Canada. Now, we're sharing that with the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Sciences. But I'm thinking about generating a campaign for matching funds, because if I can get matching funds, now I can go really fast. I can commercialize faster. I can start hiring people and
mm-hmm.
getting jobs
mm-hmm.
in Maryland. You can imagine how many landfills there are and carbon emitters just in the state, how many jobs that would generate.
Well, good luck to you, Bob.
Dan,
this sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
If I get a chance, I'd like to come out and visit the plant.
I'd love to have you out
there.
See
the algae growing out there. Bob Moroz, M-R-O-Z, is CEO of High Tech Bio. That's H-Y-T-E-K Bio. And he's been talking to us about his project out there at Back River, reducing emissions by growing algae fast.
Absolutely.
Good luck to you again.
Thanks, Dan.
When we come back, folks, another short break here on Midday. Sarah Gantz is going to be joining us this time. She's from the Baltimore Business Journal, talking about her story today regarding the new Horseshoe Casino in Baltimore and whether it will get to hire as many local residents as had been hoped. And the old Peel Museum, pardon me, near Baltimore City Hall has been closed for 17 years. There's a plan to do something about that. We'll hear about it when we get back. Midday listeners and moviegoers, a question. Name the actor or actress who surprised you, the star you didn't see coming, or the particular performance that showed an extraordinary talent not previously seen. Coming up in hour two of Midday Friday, Hollywood's unexpected turns to greatness. Midday on Film with Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed, after the news at one. And welcome back to Midday Friday. Dan here, joined now by Sarah Gantz of the Baltimore Business Journal. She has an interesting and kind of a troubling story in the Baltimore Business Journal today regarding the new Horseshoe Casino in Baltimore and the expressed ambition to hire as many local residents as possible down there. I think their full hiring is going to be something like 1,700, but there's a problem with that. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Am I right? Is that the operative number, about 1,700 employees for the new casino?
Yes, they're looking to hire around 1,700 people to work at the casino, all kinds of jobs, from people who manage the games to administrative positions, basically everyone you would need to run that casino.
And they've already done some hiring, and then they have a big hiring event coming up, a sort of a job fair, right?
Yeah, so they have an event coming up at M&T Bank Stadium. It's May 5th through 7th. They're looking to hire around 1,000 people at that event, and they've already hired around 500 people to work their table games. So they're zeroing in on getting those people hired. The casino is supposed to be opening late August or early September, so they want to make sure they have everyone on board and trained to be ready to go.
Boy, that project has really been on the fast track. But the problem that you describe in your story today has to do with the hiring policy or the hiring rules as set out by the Lottery Commission here in Maryland.
That's right. So in Maryland, casino jobs are regulated by the Lottery Commission. The state sets these rules. There is a limit on who can get these jobs. Anyone who's committed what's called a crime of moral turpitude in the last 7 years won't be able to get a job at the casino. There used to be a lifetime ban, so anyone who had committed one of those crimes would not be allowed to work at the casino. But last year, they eased those restrictions and are focusing now on crimes committed within the last 7 years. So crimes of moral turpitude, there isn't a hard and fast definition of that, but loosely it boils down to things that would maybe come into question your trustworthiness, your moral compass, things like fraud, theft.
Fraud and theft. So this covers a lot of different jobs, I assume, from household staff to people who work tables, people waiters and waitresses, that kind of thing, right? The whole gamut.
Right, yeah. Pretty much anyone who's working inside the casino, some of the restaurants that will be based there will do their own hiring, but casino employees who work in the casinos, who this affects, which is just about all of those 1,700 jobs.
So the problem is that in Baltimore City, if you want to hire Baltimore City residents, which is a worthy ambition for a casino that's based here, you run into problems with people who have criminal records, committed crimes within the last 7 years. Those are the people who need to get employed in many cases.
Right. So the problem, that is exactly the problem. A lot of our residents, employed and unemployed, have criminal records. So this has sort of shed a light on a larger problem in Baltimore, the fact that a criminal record for a lot of people stands in the way. Baltimore has around 24,000 unemployed residents last time I checked. So, you know, with 1,700 jobs, they can still probably fill those jobs with Baltimore residents who don't have a criminal record. But for a lot of people, this is, a reminder of jobs that they can't have because of past mistakes that they've made and have maybe since moved past.
Do you have any sense of whether the state would reconsider this? Have you heard from any of the leadership, say, in the General Assembly or the City Council regarding this?
You know, I don't know that they're reconsidering it. They did make that change to make it focus within the past 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, a lot of states still have a lifetime ban. I've heard anecdotally that Maryland's rules are a little bit more liberal than some other states that still focus on a lifetime ban. So I haven't heard from anyone specifically about any effort or initiative to change that.
All right. Look for Sarah Gantz's story for more details about this today in the Baltimore Business Journal. Sarah, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Dan.
We turn now to the Peel Museum, the story of the Peel Museum. The Peel Museum is just a block from Baltimore's City Hall. It's considered the nation's oldest museum building. I did not know this until I started digging into it a little bit for today's show. It opened in 1814, so it's 200 years old. It has had a number of uses over the years, but it has been closed. The Peel has been closed since 1997. Our next guests want to see it reopened as the Peel Center for Baltimore History and Architecture. Jim Diltz is a journalist and writer and historian. He serves as president of the board of directors of the Peel. Jim, it's nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be here.
And Walter Shamu is a Baltimore architect, also a member of the board at the Peel. Walter, nice to have you in the studio.
Very happy to be here.
Yeah, a lot of people like me surprised to hear that the Peel is that old, Jim?
I think so. It's Rembrandt opened it in
Rembrandt Peel,
one of the Peel family of artists, opened the museum in 1814. He was doing so because his father, Charles Wilson Peel, who was the sort of godfather, I guess, of the first family of American artists, the father, Charles Wilson, didn't really want his son to open the museum here because he thought his future was as a painter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in this family of artists, the father, Charles Wilson Peel, named several of his children after famous artists. There was Rembrandt, Rubens, Titian, Raphael, and so on and so on. And he was quite prolific, not only with his artworks. He had 17 children. And he wanted Rembrandt to pursue a career as a portrait artist, as the father had. And he was not happy that he opened the museum here because the museum business was a tough one. The father had found out.
I read that the museum opened, I think it was August 1814, and then we had the bombardment of Baltimore Harbor by the British like a month later, and Rembrandt and his family took shelter in the Peel Museum. So it served that purpose, too. It was a bomb shelter for a little while, right?
Well, I guess so. Maybe Rembrandt thought so. The father also was a patriot. Well, the son was, too, but and he had fought in the Revolution, his son Rembrandt was a pacifist, and he believed that if the British came to burn Baltimore, as they had Washington, D.C., and his museum had just opened the month before, and if he was there staying in the building with his family, he had, I think at that point, seven children, and his wife was pregnant, that the British would think it was his home and not burn it down. So that's what he did.
Walter Shamu, you know, some people may look at that building from the outside and think it was somebody's home. It looks sort of like a big row house to some people. It's in that block to the, what is it, to the east of City Hall, I guess that is, or the south of City Hall. It's across from the municipal building, right?
Across from the Able Building, just north of City Hall.
Could you describe it for our listeners?
Well, it's a Federal-style, in quotes, row house. If you had to look up in Dorsey and Diltz, Jim's book on the Peel, It is basically a Federal-style row house. But Robert Carey Long, the architect, actually recessed a panel up over the central doorway and recessed the doorway back. So it looks pretty much as a municipal building might look, and it did serve, as you know, as City Hall for a while. But it's a remarkable building.
Well, we got to talk about the uses of it over the years.
Sure.
You just mentioned it was City Hall for a while. It started off as a museum, right?
Started as a museum, and that lasted about 14 or 15 years till 1828 or so. And then I believe it became the first colored school, male and female colored school in Baltimore.
Hmm.
And then it went on to be City Hall for a few years. Then it was office buildings. Then in 1928, it was pretty much abandoned and was going to be torn down. That's when Wilbur Hunter and the city stepped in and started the Peel Museum in downtown Baltimore.
And it was restored.
Restored.
And reopened as a museum.
Restored by an architect, John Scarf, did all the work.
And Jim Diltz, what kind of museum was it?
It was the city's municipal museum, and it was established in 1930 to show people in Baltimore the industrial history of the city, and to display artifacts and to display artworks. The city, when the Peel Museum closed, inherited a lot of the famous Peel paintings, and they were displayed there. And so it was sort of a combination of art and history.
They closed down in 1997. The city, I think, my memory was that the city ran out of money, just didn't have money to keep it open. Is that basically it?
That's pretty much it. It had become part of the City Life Museums, and when which was a consortium of museums in Baltimore, and when that failed, then the Peel failed also.
Walter Shamu, back to you. What would you like to see happen here? What would be the Peel Center for Baltimore history and architecture?
Well, it would be a lot of what it was, but it would be more. There'd be a place on the second floor where there's an auditorium, a small gathering space where we could have lectures, forums. We could begin and lead from there architectural walking tours of downtown. We're a short distance down to the harbor. We could certainly do exhibits on Baltimore architecture as it's developed over the years and what's going on in the city. It's all there. It's about 10,000 square feet, needs a new roof, which the city has offered to put on for about $130,000, hopefully this summer. Mm-hmm. And then we've got to address all the other issues, certainly ADA, new toilet rooms. We're proposing an elevator on the outside, on the backside of the building. We're proposing a small cafe so that there's actually a sustainable portion of this building where people can come. City Hall and city workers are by the hundreds down
there. Yeah, right across the street.
Right. And
so you want to keep it active, want to keep it busy. So it's not a museum you drive by and maybe has limited hours or something like that, and people forget about it.
Well, hopefully it'll be very busy.
I mean that's what happens. The museums that aren't open all the time like that.
Well, there's always the question of why go there. And there's got to be stuff for everybody, and it has to be across the whole spectrum of Baltimore and the visiting firemen who come. And by the way, the visiting firemen came a year ago, and they couldn't believe we had it here. This is this original museum building. The American Museum Association came to town. We entertained them at the Peel, and they were awestruck by the building.
I'm interested in that. The nation's oldest museum building. That is, Jim, actually a building built to be a museum.
Correct.
So it may not be the oldest museum in the United States. Or is it the oldest museum building?
The building is important. The oldest museum, or one of the oldest, was the Fathers in Philadelphia, Charles Wilson Peel. And he wanted it to be a national museum, and he asked the federal government for money to do that, but he didn't make it. It was actually the precursor of the Smithsonian.
So, do you have the city's approval to go ahead and raise funds for this purpose? Has your plan been approved for the Peel Center for Baltimore History and Architecture?
There's a $250,000 city bond that will be on the ballot this year for the Peel Center, and yes, they have. We have the backing of the mayor for this project, and we're on the verge of signing a dollar-a-year lease with the city for the building, and we're very close to doing that.
Oh, so Baltimore City residents, voters, get to vote on this in November.
They do,
right.
Yes.
And so the plans are there online. I found your website. We put a link to it on my Facebook page if folks want to see what you have in mind there, Walter.
We have conceptual plans, and we have a budget. We have about a $2.5 million restoration
budget.
What
do you like about the building? You're the architect. We only got a couple of minutes here. But, I mean, what do you like?
Well, I like the history of it, for sure.
Yeah.
But then again, there it is in downtown Baltimore. It has a beautiful garden out back that needs to be restored. Has some artifacts from other buildings that Robert Carey Long, the architect, had designed for the Union Bank at Charles and Fayette Street, which is now gone. So this is a piece of Baltimore that we're hanging on to, and I think it's important that we keep it. It's a, you know, for an architect to say, well, it's a beautiful building, that's not enough. There's
mm-hmm.
a huge history that could be read into this building. I think the citizens of Baltimore could get behind it and enjoy it. We're one of the few cities right now of our size in the nation that doesn't have a municipal museum, and this can be a whole new opportunity for the city.
Walter Shamu is a Baltimore architect. He serves on the board of directors of the Peel Center, and Jim Diltz, longtime Baltimore journalist, used to work at the Baltimore Sun, a writer, historian here, is the president of that board. We wish you both good luck with this. Thanks for coming in and talking about it.
Thank you, Dan.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Midday Weekly Review, we close out this hour with a chat with Paula Gallagher. Paula is a librarian, of course, with the Baltimore County Library. She joins us from time to time to recommend some books. So this weekend, if you're looking for something to read, Paula has a couple of recommendations. Both these books are about the high-octane, high-pressure world of the professional chef. And one's a novel, and one's a memoir. Paula, how you doing?
Great, Dan. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. No, thanks for this. This sounds interesting. You want to start with the memoir or the novel?
Let me start with the memoir, Dan.
Yeah.
This book is called Sous Chef, and the subtitle is 24 Hours on the Line.
Hmm.
And the author is a guy named Michael Gibney, and what he's doing, he's had firsthand experience cooking in a number of prominent New York City restaurants, and he's come up with a composite experience, and he's taking the reader through all the minutiae of what it takes to produce a day's worth of service in a busy high-end kitchen. So you're really right there with him for the tedium and the physically demanding jobs, the psychologically grueling experience, all the teamwork that keeps that high-end restaurant running smoothly and impressively.
That sounds good, Paula. Sous Chef by Michael Gibney.
Okay. Yes.
And so, and what's the novel? The novel is about a chef.
The novel's also about a chef, also a guy who's done some work in the kitchen. This one's British, and it's set in a macho kitchen in a London gastropub that has aspirations of being something really great. And the author, the book is called Chop Chop, and the author is Simon Rowe, which with a W. And it's following this young guy who's a newly graduated English major, and he, of course, has no job, no job prospects. And he lands a job as a lowly prep cook at this restaurant called The Swan. And he's hired by a tyrannical, megalomaniac chef named Bob, even though this guy has no kitchen experience. And the reason they hire him is simply because people keep leaving, which should be a red flag for him, but he needs the job.
Well, this will sound familiar to anybody who's worked in a restaurant, probably.
Really? Yeah, really does. So he's a body in the kitchen. And, you know, people who will want to read this because it's got a really vividly drawn cast of misfits. You know, some of them are ambitious, some of them are not. The kitchen setting really is a character unto itself. And the author's descriptions and the specialized terminology really draws you into that kitchen. And it's a really funny, often profane, fast-paced read.
And you say it's profane. Is it funny?
Oh, very funny, yeah. It's very funny. But it's, you know, it's not for the squeamish or somebody who doesn't mind some cursing. I feel like he really is capturing. If you've ever read Anthony Bourdain, any of his books, or watched him on television,
yeah,
you know he's kind of a raw personality. And that same kind of flavor is in this novel.
And does the novel make you hungry at all?
You know, it can in spots. It can in spots. It doesn't give you a lot of the great descriptions of the food. It's more as the plate is passed from person to person and what this person is putting on it and saucing it and all of that. Yeah, it could. I think Sous Chef probably, the memoir probably will make you more hungry.
Okay, Paula, those sound good. Sous Chef by Michael Gibney. Again, the subtitle with that?
24 Hours on the Line.
On the Line. And then Chop Chop by Rowe.
Exactly.
Very good. All right, Paula. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Paula Gallagher, Baltimore County librarian who blogs as Paula G. You can find a link to her blog on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. And also her recommendations, if you didn't get a chance to write them down, her recommendations are on that page as well. Also on that page, you'll find, if you get to Facebook today and you want to post a comment there, what's coming up in the second hour, this ought to be interesting, from subpar to movie star, we might call it, the stars we didn't see coming. Coming up in the second hour of our show is Midday on Film with Christopher Llewellyn Reed and Linda DeLibro, as usual. But this time we pose the question to you, who is the actor or actress who really surprised you? You might have seen them first on television, first in B-movies. You weren't that impressed. You might have seen them in a big movie. You weren't that impressed. And then suddenly one day, pow, this person becomes a great actor or gives a great performance. Maybe in the past was just a character actor or somebody like that you didn't pay that much attention to, and then suddenly, wow, Oscar nomination, at least in your mind. So that's what we'll be doing in the second hour of our show today. So thank you for joining us for the first hour of Midday Friday. We close out here by thanking Joe's Squared Pizza for providing lunch for our guests, as they do every Friday. Boy, they really bring some nice pizza over here, don't they? That's really delicious. Four different kinds of pizza for our guests and our staff as well. So anyway, folks, stay tuned for the news that's coming up from NPR. And then the second hour of our show, Midday on Film, Chris and Linda will be here shortly.